Second big panel of the day, this one is broadly titled, and I think the subjects will be even more broad, which is great, and I welcome that. Assessing Market Power and Anti-Competitive Conduct in Dynamic Innovation-Driven Markets, Economic and Legal Lessons from US v. Microsoft. There are lots of lessons, so I hope we'll hear things all over the place. We have five great panelists with us today. I will go in the order very quickly, introduce them in the order in which they're going to speak. First is Frank Fisher, who, as most of you know, was the DOJ's testifying expert witness at the Microsoft trial. Frank has the rare and possibly unprecedented distinction of being the expert economist on opposite sides of two of the biggest antitrust cases in the 20th century, the government side in US v. Microsoft, the defense side, IBM side, and the government's unsuccessful, at that point, antitrust case against IBM in the 70s. Distinction also shared on the lawyering side by David Boies, who we will hear from later today. Frank is the Carleton Professor of Microeconomics Emeritus at MIT, where he taught for many, many, many years, testified in many antitrust cases beyond these two. Following Frank, Harry First, who is a professor of law at NYU and was from 1999 till 2001 the chief of the Antitrust Bureau at the New York State Attorney General's office, where he was deeply and heavily involved in this case. In the middle of our panel, we have a substitution, Tim Bresnahan from Stanford, who had been a DOJ chief economist for a time, is not able to be here because of a last-second family medical emergency. In his place, somewhat unexpectedly for him, and I apologize about that, Jay, is Jay Himes, who is the current chief of the Antitrust Bureau of the state of New York, a position you've held since when, Jay? Remind me. Seems like a very long time, but when did you... 2001. So Jay came in right as the settlement stuff was underway, was there every step of that, and has been very, very heavily involved in all of the compliance and enforcement efforts with Microsoft since that time on behalf of the plaintiff state group. We'll shift then to Keith Hilton, who is a professor of law at Boston University. He's written widely about antitrust, and in particular written a great deal about this case, and has focused a lot of attention lately on the European Union case against Microsoft and some comparisons between the EU case and the US case. And then our final panelist will be Doug Melamed, who is now a partner at WilmerHale, has been involved in a lot of the last few years' biggest cases at the intersection of antitrust and intellectual property. But during the Microsoft case, was initially principal deputy assistant attorney general to Joel Klein during the investigation, preparation, and trial of the case. And then after Joel left the division, became the acting assistant attorney general in charge of the antitrust division. So we welcome you all. We're very glad we're here. And we'll start off with Frank.
Well, thank you. I'm going to begin by giving my stock reply to people who point out that I was on opposite sides in those two cases. The nasty reply is that if you really think that these were opposite sides, then you don't understand anything about either case. But since that's not true of you, you must understand about at least one of them. I do feel about what happened in the intervening years. It's like Mark Twain's remark about his father. Mark Twain said that when I was 14 years old, I thought my father was too stupid to live. By the time I was 21, I was amazed to learn how much the old man had learned in the intervening 7 years. That's the way I feel about the antitrust division. I'm serious about that, by the way. I mean that as a great compliment to the antitrust division of the Microsoft case era. I'm too polite to say that I mean it as a great insult to the previous one, but I do. Okay. And they deserved it. All right. Now, we all have our memories of the Microsoft case. I actually have a physical memento, which I'm going to describe to you in a moment, but it bears on some of the things that we've been talking about and some of the questions that have been raised. I was asked on cross-examination, there wasn't anything for me but cross-examination, because the direct testimony went in written form. I was asked, what would be the harm if Microsoft were to win the case? And I think that is the same proposition as what would be the harm as if there had been no case at all. And that's an interesting question. And as I was asked that question, the questioner, Mr. Lacavara, took a long time asking it, and I suddenly realized, I had the time to realize that what I was going to say was certainly going to make a soundbite on every news station in the country. That, of course, did not stop me. And what I said was that we would live in a Microsoft world when it came to technology in this area. That it might be a good world and it might be a bad world, but it would be a Microsoft-controlled world. Microsoft would control what the innovations could be that worked with Windows or worked or might have been competitive to Windows. And I said that that was the modern equivalent of Henry Ford saying that the consumer can have any color car he wants so long as it is black. And indeed, that evening, that was on all the newscasts, at least that's what my family said. Now, I have a physical memento related to that, which I'm going to tell you because I think it's amusing. That happened, I think, in December, if I'm not mistaken. And shortly after that came the break for the holidays. And my son and his wife prepared for me a Hanukkah present, which I had not expected. They brought me a Monopoly set. Okay. And I looked inside, and the first thing I discovered was that Bill Gates's face was on the $500 bill. And the second was that all the properties around the board had been stickered over to be software applications, except for the utilities, which were software utilities. And I said, yes. I said, that's highly amusing. Oh, they said, you haven't gotten the point yet. What piece do you want to represent you on the board? So I went to the bags that hold the pieces that represent you on the Monopoly board, and every one of them was filled with nothing but little black cars. All right. Now, and I do think that was, you know, that was a prediction of, I can't say it came true, obviously, because we don't know what the world, for sure, what the world would have been like. But as I've listened to what's going on today, my view is that I was probably right, and that what has happened as a result of the case is that we don't live in that kind of world. I was particularly impressed by Brad Smith's remarks on this subject, but I had come to that conclusion beforehand, and I'm glad to hear it. I do think that Ed Felton's dichotomy between increased competition and technological innovation, it's very hard to decide between them, but I do think it's in some sense a false dichotomy because innovation doesn't just come about because somebody gets struck with a good idea. Innovation typically costs money, and innovation does come about if people see a reason to believe it's going to be profitable, or they're pressured to do it for fear of falling behind. And that means that competition can, in fact, be a spur to innovation, or the possibility of competing can do that. So while I don't know, those technological innovations which happened after 2003 may perfectly well have been in part a consequence of the increased competition introduced by the case. I note that the remedy didn't go into effect until around then. All right. Now, what else do I think about the lessons to be learned from the case? Well, I think the most important lesson is that there is no need to revise antitrust law or Section 2 in order to deal with innovative industries. I'm not now talking about the recent paper issued by the Justice Department. I'm going to say some things about that later. But if you think about what the economics of the case were, boiled down, they're the following. And I'm assuming you all know about the applications barrier to entry and how it works and so forth. That Microsoft found itself in a position in which it certainly had monopoly power as a result of a natural effect involving economies of scale and network effects. And had it done nothing more, there wouldn't have been a case. Microsoft did, however, do things more. It took actions to stop threats, or nascent threats, to the application's barrier to entry, the most famous one from the browser, but also from Java. And it did that even though the actions that it took were not profitable in themselves. I quote, I know you're going to think I'm a total nerd when I tell you I can quote this exhibit by number, but it's the only exhibit I can quote by number. I only know two things from the trial I can quote, I'm sorry, exactly. That's one, and another is a piece of the trial transcript in which I said, in fact, you have to remember there was a time when computers were great angry beasts, and now they are not the small angry beasts that they have since become. And the transcript has me saying, you must remember there was a time when consumers were great angry beasts. But anyway, Government Exhibit 39. I don't remember who wrote the email, but I do remember that it says, the browser is a no-revenue product, but you should care about it just as much as does Bill Gates, and it goes on in effect to say, because if we lose the browser wars, we lose everything. And that was a perfectly true statement, or at least the first part of it was a perfectly true statement. Microsoft invested an awful lot in improving Internet Explorer, and it also gave it away. And it paid people usually in kind, or in not taking their money, in various ways, if they would agree to adopt it. These are the PC people and other things surrounding that. And this was an act which had, a set of acts which had no particular justification on its own right. Microsoft said, well, we wanted them to advertise Internet Explorer, so we gave them inducements to take it. But the browser was a no-revenue product. Why do you want everybody to have Internet Explorer? And so on. And that's an anti-competitive act. I don't care whether that happened in an innovative industry or in a non-innovative industry. That sort of thing undertaken by a company with a great deal of market power, which Microsoft certainly had, is anti-competitive. And that's basically what the liability case was about. And the fact that Microsoft was, and I hope still is, innovative is interesting and important, but has nothing to do with that. I don't say that innovative companies or innovation generally doesn't present new areas to think about when dealing with antitrust cases, but it doesn't, I think, call for a basic revision of the standards. Okay. A few more lessons. One should, of course, this is a self-serving comment. You have to understand that, even though I am semi-retired from the expert witnessing business. You should try to understand the economics of the case before you jump in. Right? I'm really serious about that. This is not the worst example. I can't help doing it. Where'd he go? David's not here, right? Well, I should. Boys. Well, tell him I said this afterwards. The worst example I know was another case in which I worked with David Boyce, in which the complaint was drawn up far in advance, and the economics were all very peculiar in the complaint. But once you try to do that, had that been done and done properly, I think perhaps the tie-in claim would not have been there. I said yesterday that the tie-in claim doesn't make any real sense. Because monopolization of the browser market for its own sake didn't make any sense. The browser, as I said, was a no-revenue product. And at the time, anyway, there weren't a lot of profits to be earned by monopolizing it. It was being monopolized, the actions were being taken to protect the monopoly power in the operating systems market. You would be surprised, by the way, this has nothing to do with the behavior of the counsel in either case. During the case, I received at least two, and I think more, papers some to referee for journals, by economists who had extremely elaborate theoretical models proving that it could not possibly profit Microsoft to monopolize the to tie the browser to the operating system, except under very extreme conditions. And that was just totally beside the point. They were perfectly good papers, but they weren't about this case, despite the fact that the authors obviously thought they were. On the other hand, one of the things I'm now going to shade into the... On the other side of the case, I always thought that Microsoft did an awful lot of trying to fight this case in the court of public opinion. And in fact, even in court, tried to fight it as a marketing case in various ways, pointing out how important their product was, how innovative they had been, and so forth. And in certain respects, which I don't want to go back into because it's probably too painful, just not being very careful, and their lawyers not being very careful about what was happening in the exhibits that they tried to put in. I'm not going to go into detail. It's not necessary. Okay. Now, I come now to the recent statement of the Justice Department and the objections by the FTC. I cannot say that I have studied these in detail. So this is a top-of-the-head reaction to some of it. Or perhaps a back-of-the-envelope react. I'm not using reading from an envelope, but you know what I mean. Okay. I think there's something to be said, but probably not everything to be said, for the Justice Department's position. If, in fact, it does, as I think it tries to do in some respects, the following. Lawyers are just terribly, terribly fond of bright-line tests. And, of course, they're fond, or at least the plaintiffs are always fond, of per se tests. And in anything but the simplest circumstances, those things don't really work very well. They particularly don't work very well for tying cases. And if what the DOJ is saying about the rule of reason there is, you know, we're going to get serious about examining the economics of what's going on and not rely on fairly silly tests like how much is outside and how much is inside the bundle, which in cases more complicated than the standard classic tie, is very, very difficult to make any sense of, and possibly even in the standard case, then I think that's a rather good idea. I do agree that if you get rid of things like that, it's going to make it easier for people who want to take anti-competitive actions to get away with it. I think that under Section 2. That's true. And I'm sorry, I don't know anything. I don't really know anything about the people who now work for the Justice Department, but one can't help feeling that that's not, how shall I put it, dissonant with the general behavior of the present administration in Washington. You like that?
Yeah, I like that.
Okay. On the other hand,
I like it. Yeah.
Yes. On the other hand, there is another thing in there of which I thoroughly approve. And now I'm going to say something that annoyed me about the states. Sorry. Okay. As a number of you probably know, I am a principal proponent of the proposition that you can't look at accounting profits and infer anything at all about monopoly. In the early days of putting that forward, you would think that I had tried to deface the National Monument, as I once pointed out, but never mind. I'm not going to go through that argument again. And indeed, in the Microsoft case, I pretty well insisted to the DOJ that that not be a part of their case. I insisted successfully. It was, however, a part of the state's cases. Oh, well, you're a witness. Rick Warren Bolton got up and testified to that. Well, I got asked every morning of my cross-examination whether I agreed with the quote from Rick Warren Bolton that profits really mattered. Okay, good. Then I apologize. I apologize. But I did get Rick did say something about it. I was there. Yeah, all right, he wrote something. And I got asked every morning about that proposition. And I had an answer, but okay. But anyway, but I am delighted. Really delighted. I thought this was coming from some call I had previously with the a couple of years ago from the antitrust division. I am really delighted to discover that in the new paper from the DOJ, there is a section on profits that essentially says you can't do this. You know, that this is very unreliable evidence. And I think that's right. And I'll stop with another short memento. You know, I lived through the IBM case. I lived through it for many, 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 many years. I couldn't attend the first meeting on the case in May of 1970 because my youngest child was being born and my wife thought I should be there. The case lasted so long that that same child read galley proof on my book, which appeared not long after the case. But anyhow, in the course of this, the wealth of evidence about profits and the discussion about profits, it was appalling, not to mention bizarre. And I'm really glad to see, as I said before, that the DOJ had learned something in the intervening whatever number of years it has been. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Harry?
So I'm glad this was up behind Frank all the time, so you were really watching the title of my slides as he was speaking. I thought as I was thinking about what in the world I was going to say here, and I wrote some stuff down, it occurred to me that what I was writing through the whole thing really bore this title, "Is the Microsoft Case Important?" And then I thought, what better group to ask this to than a group of Microsoft junkies? Because you, certainly I, have invested an awful lot in the Microsoft case. Probably thank ourselves, thank God they brought this case because it's kept us busy for so long. And, everyone would probably initially say, of course, it was important. But then you might also say, well, was it important? And maybe even more interestingly, as I listen to the discussion, important in what ways? Because we do have a variety of perspectives from, legal perspectives, business perspectives, technology community, and so forth. And there might be a number of different ways in which it is or isn't important. So that's my title, and I'm sticking to it, as they say. So I'm going to talk about three things. Reframing would be one. The second is the evolution of the case, which I think is interesting to think about. And then third, remedy, which I think is really pretty critical. So we have the what Andy and I have written about this a little bit. You can think of as the frames that have been put around the case, which have varied from time to time. So you have the original frame of the case, which came in the complaints. And I thought it was interesting when Phil described the complaints yesterday. You started with the third claim in the complaint, which was the monopolization claim. But actually, the first claim was exclusive dealing and other anti-competitive effects. The second claim was tying. The third claim was monopolization. And the fourth was attempt to monopolize the browser market. Now, I didn't write the complaint, so I don't know. But you would think you would start with the thing that's sort of most important in the case as number one. So even from the initial frame of the case, we start to think about it a little differently. There was, of course, all the anti-competitive conduct, cut off the air supply and all of that, and the monopolization claim. And I say complaints because we have to remember we've heard a lot about the states here. The states had a somewhat different complaint, not completely, but broader in the initial complaint. It included the DOS story we heard yesterday. It included a claim about office and the pricing of office. And it also included interoperability of software generally. Now, as it became clear that Judge Jackson was not going to have a trial to last forever, like the IBM case, the states pulled back some of those claims in a first amended complaint and narrowed the framework. But when we got to trial, the frame expanded a little bit again. It wasn't just the jihad to win the browser war. I always love that. We love certain Microsoft documents. That's the one I like, which was quoted in the complaint. Browsers were now transformed into middleware, a much larger product. And other things came in besides the browser war. So you had things about real networks and streaming technology. You had IBM's OS. You had other things that came into the trial. And this is what Judge Jackson dealt with in his findings of fact, this much broader framework of the story. On appeal, it changed again. Narrower. Appeals do that necessarily. Appeals courts don't sit to listen to everything. And we were back to the browser war as the focus. But I think the real reframing, in a sense, comes in the Court of Appeals opinion itself and the methodology that it brought to the case with using the rule of reason. Because whatever one thinks about that as an approach, in the D.C. Circuit's hands, what it meant was segmenting all of Microsoft's conduct into sort of bite-size, that's B-I, not B-Y, bite-size pieces, which could then be analyzed. Some were good, some were bad, we'll throw this out, this was bad, this was good. And in some ways, by not looking at the conduct overall as a whole, which was how I think Judge Jackson saw it, and I think how it was presented at trial, you have this first, in a sense, trivializing of the case. Trivial in the sense that it's about discrete little pieces, and so we can see what's illegal, what's not, and it trivializes potentially the remedy as well, because then you're focused on just fixing those particular parts. I think the reframing, in a sense, of the remedy becomes particularly critical in a couple of ways. One is a statement which seems perfectly correct when made, and that's the notion that the remedy should be tailored to fit the wrong, which tailored to fit the occasion for the remedy. So this tailoring principle sounds right, but on the other hand, it really does narrow the enterprise of remedy, instead of looking more broadly, perhaps, at how you can make the market more competitive, you want to say which contractual provisions should we say you can't do. So that's one important part. The second, though, is the Court of Appeals notion of what the government's role and how we're going to think about Section 2 in a way. There's a bit at the beginning of the Court of Appeals opinion where it talks about how because this is a high technology industry, it's one of the few places, Frank is right, where the court really talks about high technology, we might not have an effective remedy. There might not be an effective conduct remedy. There might not be an effective structural remedy. Oh, well. So what does that mean that perhaps the courts move so slowly? It means, and this is the full quote, I've got it on the slide, the government will continue to have an interest in defining the contours of the antitrust laws so that law-abiding firms will have a clear sense of what is permissible and what is not. And the threat of private damage actions will remain to deter those firms inclined to test the limits of the law. So the government's in the business of just bringing cases to set precedent. I guess you can do that just by writing a 230-page report. And, that's just as good because, and why bother to go to trial? It's more efficient to do it that way. That's their view. And the private parties will take up the slack. Now, subsequent events may have indicated what perhaps was in the Court of Appeals' minds, that's a pretty ineffective remedy. It's going to be really hard for private parties to do this. So it's a very, it's in a sense reframing Section 2 as well that's going on in the Court of Appeals case. So the second part is the evolution of the case. And in some sense, from my point of view, this is where it gets interesting. I noticed that this is the title that Phil has picked is U.S. versus Microsoft 10 years later. And the title of my remarks is The Microsoft Case, because in 1998, the European case started when Sun complained to the Europeans. And the case has continued to evolve, not only in how the remedies worked, but in litigation after the settlement in 2001. So there are two particular parts that I think we should think about. One is the importance of intellectual property and innovation. Intellectual property in the U.S. case was sort of a sideshow. Microsoft's arguments were, I would say, sort of incoherent. I don't know if any of the people who crafted them are here, so be it. Jackson sort of brushed them aside. The D.C. Circuit said they bordered on the frivolous. Go to Europe, though. Microsoft brings these arguments much more front and center, and I think it was a very wise move for a number of reasons. One is, of course, one of the two claims of abusive dominance deals with an intellectual property right. It said you didn't give Sun information, and Microsoft says we had an intellectual property right to refuse to license this information. So you have this direct conflict. But the second is the importance of innovation. It was there at trial, if you recall Jackson's penultimate paragraph, I don't remember the number, 403, well, anyway, someone knows it here, where, you know, he talked about how, you know, Microsoft's behavior hobbled a form of innovation. Right? But that sort of dropped out of the case, in a way, on appeal, because it's really hard to prove what that means. But Microsoft made this a very important part of its argument to the European Commission, ultimately to the Court of First Instance, that it invested billions of dollars in these protocols, the communications between server to server and server to the PC. And if you don't let us get a return on that investment, we won't innovate anymore, nor will anyone else. A key argument about the connection between intellectual property rights and innovation. The European Commission didn't accept the argument, talked about the importance, and it's something that's come out in discussion here, the importance of competition itself on Microsoft's incentives to innovate, that, as the Commission said, sharing with Sun and having them as a more viable competitor might liven up competition in the marketplace. The CFI just simply said, I think, well, this was Microsoft's burden to show that it wouldn't innovate, and they didn't carry that burden. But you can also see, and I have this here, the Justice Department's concern over time and the evolution about intellectual property rights can be seen a bit in their own press releases. In 2004, when Hugh Pate complained about the European Commission decision as being just wrongheaded, he said about the interoperability part that sort of considerably overlapped with the remedy in the U.S. side, which required compulsory disclosure of the protocols. But by the CFI decision in 2007, the Justice Department had changed its tune and now was complaining about how the forced disclosure of this information could chill innovation and would involve potential harms to consumers. Dominant companies should be allowed to refuse to license intellectual property rights. It's become much more of a theme from the Justice Department and much more concern. This has continued actually on the European side. I don't know, some people here have read a speech and a paper that was given by Bo Westerdorf, who was the president of the CFI. Last thing he did was see this case come down. He retires, and then he writes about it. Sort of like Steve Williams saying, let me tell you about what really went on in the Court of Appeals. But Not that Westerdorf says that, but what does come through in this is his great concern that the CFI decision will harm innovation and will cut down on intellectual property rights holders. So this is a continuing evolution of the case. Institutionally, the evolution through the European Commission shows that, as I've said, DOJ no longer rules. This is a global world that we're living in, and I think Brad Smith made this point in his remarks. If one of the things that's really important about the Microsoft case is the evolution of antitrust into a global enterprise. It is not just restricted to what happens in the United States, and we just can't think of it that way. So as much as the Justice Department, as the dominant firm, would like to maintain its dominance, it does face other institutional enforcers, and I think that's one of the important parts of the evolution. So let's talk about remedies, which is sort of the end game, I think. Just a brief slide here. Consumer suits, lots of them, 220, 80% class actions, lots of legal hurdles, as we know. Settlements, mostly voucher settlements, but not just for Microsoft products. The total value of these I actually don't have a figure on, nor does Microsoft apparently, although I'm glad to hear it if they're willing. They've got it now. But my understanding is until all the dust settles and the Cypre stuff is figured out, we won't know. It's substantial. The end time is roughly 2012. This will put it almost two decades from the time when Bill Gates wrote his internet title memo, just to give a sense. We're going to have this conference 10 more years from now, don't worry. Competitor suits. This is real money. Quoting our speaker before, $3.4 billion if you add it all up, and it's in all parts of the litigation. Browser wars settlements, the OS claims, the OEM claims, and one interesting part, I think, in particular, the EC case, which involved the media player and involved server operating systems, generated U.S. cases and U.S. settlements, and not insignificant amounts, and the Koreans as well. The Korean suit actually was filed in Korea, so if you're looking for other places in which to practice, think about that. Remedies in the EU. People in the room know about what the U.S. remedies are, so I'd like to focus on what may be less well known. $497 million for the two violations, abuse of dominance. That's roughly $600 million at the time. Microsoft is fortunate that the dollar was stronger then, so it cost less. Injunction, a simple injunction, as opposed to what we did in the U.S., refrain from repeating what you did. And the two behavioral remedies, unbundle media player to offer the standalone version and provide it, the information withheld from Sun on interoperability on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms, and a monitoring trustee, as we had, similar to what we have in the U.S. So on the interoperability part, November 2005, a penalty decision, the information virtually impossible to use, their experts found, and setting out in, not quite clear how this came about, but setting out what reasonable fees are supposed to be. Microsoft's, the protocols have to be their creation. The second part, I think, is the most interesting. The protocols have to be innovative and using, in effect, a patent standard, not obviousness, non-obviousness, whatever exactly that means. Some of the protocols, most are not, but some are non-patented. The commission has put those aside, just looking at the ones that were not covered by intellectual property rights and consistent with market valuation for comparable technology. And then the fines that came, $280 million for the disclosure failure, and then the biggie, in February 2008, €899 million, $1.3 billion, for unreasonable fees. And one of the interesting things of that is the annex to the commission's decision, 69 pages of going through protocol by protocol of 173 protocols, finding 166 of the technologies disclosed were not innovative. So if you're thinking back on Microsoft's claim that if they don't get to keep these secret, they won't innovate, according at least to the European Commission, well, they didn't innovate anyway. Okay, remedies effect. This is the real question. And what I did was, you know, sort of you start with the markets that were at the core of the U.S. case. Share of the OS market, these are the latest from net applications. So 91% if you include the Mac, which as we know was not included in the U.S. case. 99% roughly Linux has a trace. Share of the browser market, 72% Firefox. Of course, that wasn't a market, as we found out from the D.C. Circuit, but everyone knows it's a market. So 72% Firefox has 20%, and Chrome got 1% on its first day. How's that? So obviously a different story, but from a U.S. law point of view, 72% in most circuits in the U.S. would be monopoly power. On the European side, share of the workgroup server operating systems market, if you look at the European Commission cases, and they're always very long, always in a late paragraph or in a footnote, they say, well, actually, Microsoft's share has been increasing ever since 2004 and continues to. The Windows XP Home Edition, 1,787 copies as of April 2006. That doesn't sound like a whole lot. This was the figure that the European Commission's lawyer told the CFI in oral argument and conceded that the remedy was a failure. The reason for the failure, though, may be that the price for the unbundled and bundled was exactly the same. I wonder which one I should take. So what's the conclusion? Is the Microsoft case important? There may be many reasons to say yes or no, but one reason to say yes is thanks to Europe. I think Europe has given the whole case continued salience, as they say, and it continues to go along with the current complaints that have been filed, including a complaint that's going to start the browser war case again by Opera saying you can't bundle IE into Windows. But what do we say about the remedy? I think the civil litigation recoveries shouldn't be scoffed at. Injured consumers were compensated, and I think that's an important function for antitrust law. The civil fines, which people in the U.S. tend to scoff at, as that latest report did and the AMC did, are substantial. I think of Judge Jackson's mule trainer analogy. If you'll recall, this is one of the things he said to one of the reporters. Well, you know about the mule trainer. How does he work? He whoops him upside the head, and that's how he gets the mule's attention. So I'm not calling Microsoft the mule, but corporations generally. You look at this money, and you say, Microsoft has paid, $2.3 billion roughly in fines. You start to pay attention to that money. I don't think that's nothing. And the EU's review of Microsoft's pricing, I think, is interesting because it shows if you want to, and I leave that aside, if you want to start looking more closely at the pricing of a monopolist, it's not impossible to do, as U.S. commentators always say it is. Bottom line, though, I think, flunking remedy 101. If you look at all the remedies, we can argue over whether they've worked because no one really set out what the goals were. There were no benchmarks for whether you've achieved them or not. And my real concern is if the remedy in the end is perceived as unimportant, and I was glad that Microsoft perceives it as very important, but to think about what that means. But in the end, from a public policy point of view, if it's perceived as unimportant, it really is the ultimate bad rap against antitrust and the trivialization of antitrust, because if you don't get anything out of it, it wasn't a great case, it was a bad case to bring. So that's it.
Thanks, Harry. Jay, we've just heard about flunking remedy 101.
Yeah, on that happy note.
I like to leave it to Jay to
get the, excuse
good
me.
Grade.
Yeah. Sorry. I am Harry's successor at the New York AG's office in charge of antitrust. He left there in April, I think, of 2001, and I joined at that point. The case was up on appeal then and came down in June, if I remember. We were scheduled to come talk to Microsoft about negotiating a settlement. beginning in the fall of that year, and I was with one of my senior staff people, a fellow who tried the case because he at that point knew something about the case and I didn't, sitting in an airplane waiting to take off at 9 o'clock one morning in September, and it actually happened to be September 11th. That airplane didn't take off. We never got to the first settlement negotiations that day, but we did get ordered by the judge a couple of weeks after that to do what she described as round-the-clock negotiations, and she told us, if you can't agree after a couple of weeks, that's okay. We have a way of making you talk. and it amounted to appointing a mediator who then led the negotiations for the next month or 5 weeks, leading, of course, eventually to the settlement involving the DOJ and New York and 9 or 8 other states, and then, of course, the split off in the litigation by California, Iowa, and another group of states altogether. So that's the background that I bring to this, and I am one of these people, for better or for worse, I guess, to whom you can attribute the consent decree. It's fair, I think, that you should know how I came here. I was looking at the program a few weeks ago, and I said to Phil, gee, I see the program online. You don't have any state enforcers involved. And he said, well, you know, Jay, it's a lot of date. We think Steve Houck is going to come. He didn't mention anything about Harry, but it's nice to see him here. And Phil said to me, but if you'd like to come, we'll be happy to, you know, to find some place for you. And I said, well, let me think about that. And I came back to Phil a couple of days later. And I said, gee, I can make it up on a Saturday, you know, I'll go anywhere you think I can contribute. And Phil came back and said, well, what would you like to do? And I said, well, Saturday, there's this panel I could contribute a little bit on, and that panel I could contribute a little bit on. I didn't hear from Phil. And then, you know, about 20 minutes ago, he came up to me and said, Jay, how'd you like to be on this panel? It was good. None of the panels I'd suggested, but that's okay. You get the same pitch, I think. Harry says we flunked remedies. Certainly we didn't set out to achieve that result. I think that the objective was to, through both prohibitory provisions and through affirmative disclosures, to try to address the application's barrier to entry and to try to knock down the buttressing that we believed occurred by virtue of the exclusionary conduct that Microsoft had previously engaged in. It was through that combination of provisions an intention to try to make the industry more friendly for the development of features that would offer competition to the Windows monopoly. The Windows monopoly, as you all know, and I hope there's not terribly much repetition from yesterday, but of course it's a network, it's a product with network effects, and the application's barrier to entry is part and parcel of those network effects. And my sense, and I don't claim to be an expert on network effects, but where you get a monopoly in that kind of area, it's pretty hard to dislodge. You've got to move the platform. You've got to find somebody who can offer a different alternative altogether to the network, and that's pretty hard to do. Just breaking down the network, I think, is near impossible. So, you know, with our great foresight, what we thought was that somehow, just as middleware might operate to break down the application's barrier to entry and create the opportunity to move the platform, that if it were possible to enable features both from the internet or through competing middleware the way Netscape and Java promised, that it might be possible to introduce competition into the operating system area. And the overall objective of the remedy that we selected was designed to achieve that effect. Of course, Jackson had suggested a structural remedy. The Court of Appeals had overturned him on that. There was pretty strong language in the opinion of the Court of Appeals telling us that that was, it wasn't formally pulled off the table, but it did not appear to some of us to be a viable alternative at the point that we were on remand. The result is, what you do see in the settlement, and by, for all practical purposes, the settlement is the same as the decree that came out of the state subsequent litigation. There were some changes, but I don't think that you would call them material. We have sought, certainly in large measure through the affirmative provisions, the protocol disclosure provisions, and to a lesser extent the API provisions, to give people in the industry participants, a better opportunity to communicate with the Windows client in hopes that they could develop features that would promote a kind of cross-platform opportunities. I don't know how much of this is repetitious, but the communications protocol section of the decree, which preceded by a considerable period of time the EC's remedy, has involved an enormous industry, an enormous enforcement effort, secured in large measure through the technical committee and the software engineers that they have engaged to develop the protocol documentation and to push Microsoft into making that documentation more satisfactory to industry users. The documentation that the EC found to be wholly inadequate was the stuff we were looking at by and large. There were some minor differences we had years earlier, but non-publicly declared it to be inadequate as well. And we had developed ways to push Microsoft to make it better, and those culminated ultimately in a 2006 admission in court that the documentation they were previously relying on was indeed not satisfactory for anybody, and a commitment on Microsoft's part to rewrite it. And they have been doing that, and that process continues even today. It engages on the order of 40 engineers, software engineers that work for the technical committee out in Redmond. They have offices in Bellevue and in Palo Alto, California. That's been a very, very major effort. It engages me, it engages Steve Houck and their consultant, and DOJ people on an ongoing, regular basis. Scarcely a day goes by that I don't have communications with somebody on that activity. It involves, of course, not only the disclosure provisions, but also monitoring the operations of Windows to make sure that as Windows evolves, as IE evolves, there's a new version of the operating system, Windows 7, on the table now, that those versions are compliant with the requirements of the final judgment. And that is not, by the way, an easy task. The conduct provisions, are self-executing. You're not supposed to, there are very prohibitions against coercion of OEMs and things like that and ISVs. But keeping the operating system compliant, particularly in the places where Microsoft had to create defaults and make the operating system honor them is not an easy operation. In fact, we knew it was going to be technically challenging when we negotiated the remedies provision. And for that reason, expected we were going to have technical expertise on a regular basis. It took, I think, the technical committee over a year, frankly, to develop tools that satisfactorily probed Windows and determined whether, in fact, Windows removed all of the IE icons that it was required to remove if a user, in fact, sought to hide end-user access, which was the way of substituting middleware. Microsoft, of course, said we have rejiggered the operating system. It does it. It works if you if a user goes in and chooses Firefox as its browser instead of IE. We remove the icons. In fact, that wasn't the case. There were places in the operating system where the icons remained. The technical committee then had a dialogue with Microsoft about why that was the case. Was there some reasonable technical requirement that the final judgment permitted so that the icon and the invocation of IE was acceptable, or was it not? And getting all of those kinds of little things was very difficult. It's not an easy remedy. In that sense, this is Windows. It is not a simple thing, and just changing it is not simple. So I don't know whether you say we flunked under those circumstances. It certainly is the case that the Windows market share is formidable. And I guess when Brad spoke a few minutes ago, he mentioned consolidation in the OEM industry, and he said, you know, they've gone from hundreds of companies when the case started to a much smaller number today, and you can imagine the dialogue that Microsoft therefore has to have with the few companies that remain in the OEM business. And when he said that, I thought from time to time I hear from the OEMs, and they will voice problems to me, and they will say, we voiced these concerns to Microsoft. And the two of them talk, and that's a good thing, and they communicate about things in Windows that they don't like or changes that Microsoft proposes to make that they think aren't consistent necessarily with the OEM's attempts to differentiate their products from each other. Sometimes they accommodate each other, sometimes they don't, and that's generally when they come to me. But the point really is, when Microsoft feels one way about the operating system and the OEMs feel another way about the operating system and how they want it to work on their computers, the OEMs still don't have a plan B. There still is no other operating system that they could possibly realistically go to. And that is a condition today, and it was, of course, a condition 10 years ago. We do think that there are circumstances in the industry that will contribute to lessening that sort of position, and certainly the delivery of internet-based services, which you've heard about today and which Ed talked about today, the delivery of services through browsers, those kinds of developments are encouraging. Changes in the industry that we would hope over time in one way or another give the end user a better opportunity to choose features and choose an ability to find alternatives to Windows. But it is certainly a difficult kind of problem in a networks industry and in one that is so central to a lot of what we do today. Phil, great. I hope I've taken up my 10 minutes.
You've done a great job. Thanks, Jay. I appreciate you stepping in and appreciate you being a good sport about it, and especially not giving me a hard time about it. That's great. So, thanks. Keith Hilton.
Thanks, Phil.
15 years after, I expect a better position, okay?
Okay, I want to talk about four topics. I don't think I'll be able to get through all of them, so Phil just cut me off if I don't make it through. So I want to talk about the framing of the legal standard that Harry talked about. I want to say a little bit about that. I want to talk about remedies, a little bit about innovation and monopolization, and lastly, EU and the world, or I should say the U.S. and the world. Maybe I should put it that way. So maybe I should switch the order since everyone's been talking about remedies for the past few minutes. Maybe I should deal with remedies first because I hadn't planned to talk about that first. But you know, it strikes me that I would be worried about trying to determine the effectiveness of any remedies by looking at market share evidence or things like that. I mean, I think it's a bad way to try to determine And in particular, you'd like to ask, well, what is the best approach to remedies? And try to have some theory about remedies or what remedies are supposed to do. I think one of the best discussions of remedies in the case law is Judge Wisanski's opinion in the United Shoe decision, where he gets to remedies. And he raises some important questions about what remedies are supposed to do and the ideal approach to remedies. It seems to me that you'd like to have kind of a sliding scale approach where, to the extent that the firm's conduct has a strong efficiency component, those are the cases in which, or I should say pro-competitive, pro-consumer efficiency component, those are the cases in which you want narrow remedies, remedies that are surgical and go after exactly the kind of conduct that you think is bad and you'd like to stop. In cases where the firm's conduct doesn't have a strong efficiency component, well, yeah, then you want, large, very effective, you know, powerful remedies, and the dissolution and structural remedy approach may be desirable. So you can distinguish cases involving price fixing, just for example. You know, and I know it's not relevant to the monopolization case, but price fixing, naked price fixing, as an example of something that has no efficiency component, and therefore you don't have to worry about surgical remedies in that case. But when you've got conduct that's efficient, pro-consumer, then you really ought to be careful about remedies, and the narrow surgical remedies are best. So it doesn't strike me that you can make a decision or make a conclusion that the remedies have flunked, and I'd be worried about any approach to measuring the success of remedies by looking at market share and seeing whether you've punished a corporation as sufficiently. So the second topic I want to talk about is just the framing of the legal standard, because anyone, I guess Harry runs into this problem. He teaches antitrust, and as a teacher of antitrust, when you get to the Microsoft decision, you're asking yourself, well, what do we learn about this, and what does this tell us about the legal standard for monopolization? And just as a brief thumbnail sketch on the legal standards for monopolization, you could say roughly there are two. You know, there's a lot of talk out there about different approaches to monopolization tests, but I think they pretty much shake down to two approaches. One is something that's described often as a welfare balancing approach, and that you see in the Microsoft decision. You know, open up the Microsoft opinion, you'll see the court articulate that test, which is comparing the pro-competitive benefits of the defendant's conduct with the anti-competitive effects, pro-competitive effects versus anti-competitive effects. Maybe you could describe it sometimes as a disproportionality test. Are the anti-competitive effects disproportional to whatever pro-competitive effects have come out of the firm's conduct? It's not clear how you do that balancing, but at least in theory, that's what courts are saying. That's what the Microsoft opinion says it's going to do. And then another version you can just describe as a specific intent test, which asks, well, is there a substantial efficiency component? Does the firm's conduct increase the value of the good to consumers or lower the cost of supply? And if that's the case, then the firm can't be held liable under Section 2, and you don't engage in some kind of balancing. Now, there's a question there about how you measure intent. And you can take the specific intent approach that I've just suggested involves an objective approach to intent, where you're looking at the firm's conduct, and that's different from what you'd say is what you describe as a subjective approach to intent, where you're looking for internal emails and memoranda. And there's a lot of talk about that yesterday, and good statements of the problems with the subjective intent approach. You know, one obvious problem is it creates this incentive going forward that firms have to have lawyers look over their documents, and the unsophisticated firms, the firms that don't have lawyers look over their documents, do the same thing as their rivals do, but they're the ones that get caught and that get punished under Section 2. So that would seem to be a bizarre system where you have the only firms that get into trouble are the unsophisticated firms, whereas the sophisticated firms do the same things, but don't get into any trouble for it because there aren't these damaging emails or memoranda. So that's a serious problem with the subjective approach, and something that has led many courts to take a view that that they'd like to get away from that. For example, Judge Breyer in the Barry Wright decision is very critical of the subjective approach to assessing intent. So consistent with this specific intent approach, you know, you look at the Microsoft case and you say, well, okay, what did the firm do? Well, it seems the core of the case involves this bundling of Internet Explorer with the Windows operating system, or the technological tying of it, which increases the value of the overall operating system, and you could say lowers the cost of supply of this application, consistent with what Microsoft had been doing for a long time with standalone applications, bundling them into the operating system, which increased the value of the operating system and benefited consumers. So right away, you start off on this, thinking that if a court is going to apply a specific intent approach, that Microsoft is in a pretty good position and that the plaintiffs have a hard way to go. Okay, so I was going to say something about the evolution of this standard. You know, the first 50 years or so of monopolization law, from the passage of the statute until Learned Hand's opinion in Alcoa, the courts operated under the specific intent standard. And then Judge Hand rewrote the law in Alcoa, and we've had the welfare balancing approach since Judge Hand's Alcoa decision. So that's what we have right now, for the most part. But, you know, you can see a trend that starts developing in monopolization law roughly around 1975, roughly around the time of the Rita and Turner article on predatory pricing, which pointed to the costs of false convictions, convictions of firms that have engaged in largely efficient conduct. And after that, after the Areta and Turner article, we start seeing some decisions that start moving toward what you could say describe as a specific intent approach to monopolization cases. And so, for example, the best examples are the Trinco decision involving essential facilities, involving access to facilities that rivals say they need access to compete. So the Trinco decision is a step in the direction of the specific intent test. You have the Brook Group decision, Matsushita and Brook Group decisions moving the predatory pricing standard toward a specific intent test. So you had some movement back toward the specific intent test and a kind of fractured standard under Section 2 monopolization test. So the question was open when the Microsoft case came up. What kind of approach would the court take? Would it embrace this welfare balancing approach, or would it embrace the specific intent approach that we see in cases like Brook Group or Trinco? And the appeals court openly embraces the welfare balancing test. Now, the only problem for that, for someone who teaches, is that when the court applies the test, it does so in a way that's a little confusing and inconsistent. Some of the conduct that the court, first of all, when it applies the test, it doesn't really balance it in the few cases where it finds that Microsoft's conduct, that Microsoft has a good defense, a good pro-competitive defense. Well, it says, okay, you're okay. We don't find a violation, no real balancing. So it seems to be conducted in a way that's similar to the specific intent test. And then when you look at the kind of conduct that Microsoft, that was approved by the court, it was pretty much the same as some of the conduct that was not approved. And so it's kind of hard to see why the court picked some areas where it's some types of conduct. I mean, this is maybe what Harry was getting to when he said picking apart and picking pieces of what Microsoft did. Picked some pieces and said that's okay, and other pieces and said that's not okay, because there wasn't a big difference. And moreover, when you get to the tying part of the opinion, the court looks at some of the same conduct and decides to apply the rule of reason test. Why? Because of the efficiency arguments in favor of that conduct. So it's the opinion seems very consistent in that way, both in its treatment of Microsoft's conduct and in the way it applies the law under tying and the law under monopolization. So that that sort of muddies the picture, makes it hard to teach the law, and I assume it's hard, makes it a little difficult for lower courts to figure out what they're doing as a result of this case. All right, I was going to make a brief comment on innovation and monopolization. So, you know, even if you've got a monopoly that does nothing good, that doesn't do anything efficient or pro-consumer, just raises the price and extracts surplus from consumers and imposes a deadweight loss on the economy by restricting output, you know, even in those cases, if the firm innovates, there's still a benefit there. And there, you know, now I'm going into the famous Schumpeterian argument on monopolization. Because what the firm is doing in that case is, sure, it extracts welfare from consumers when it monopolizes. On the other hand, there's that big residual surplus that's there that consumers have that was the result of the firm's innovation. And the innovation may have been directly related to the firm's incentive. The incentive to innovate may have been directly related to the firm's ability to monopolize that market later. So even in the worst case scenario, where you have a firm that doesn't do anything efficient but innovates, there's an economic case for being careful about punishing those firms, because consumers have benefited to the extent, in fact, benefited in a big way from the residual surplus that they get as a result of the firm's innovation. And that's sort of a basic Econ 101 message that isn't stressed enough, in my view, in the courses. It's sort of mentioned on the side, oh yeah, there's the Schumpeterian argument, but it strikes me this is awfully important in a case like Microsoft, and when you apply monopolization law to innovative industries. And it's a reason to make you think carefully about the remedies and to be careful about the way you apply the monopolization standard. Okay, I was going to say, I think the last point that I'm coming to is the U.S. and the world, or the U.S. and the EU. So the experience that we've gotten out of this case is that the EU will take fairly aggressive arguments that are raised by enforcement authorities here and will run a lot further with them. And that's a problem, because we have different systems. The evolution of monopolization law here is very different from what's happening in the EU. Here we have a court-driven process, so that when the DOJ or the FTC go into court here in the U.S., they have to worry about what's going to happen, because courts are independent. Courts apply their rule of reason standard, and they have an independent reasoning process when they develop that standard. And so the FTC doesn't go into court thinking, the appeals court, or this court, is going to defer to us on important questions because, you know, we're the agency, we're the experts on this. In fact, if anything, they're often disappointed to find out how little deference they get in the courts. In the EU, it's a different ballgame, because they have a manifest error doctrine that's applied by the courts. So it's pretty much a deference rule. The European Commission gets to make decisions on economic matters, on the facts, and for the most part, the court of first instance is going to defer to the European Commission. I think it's an enormous difference, and I think it's one that is worrisome in terms of the divergence between monopolization law in the U.S. and in the EU. The European Commission is in a position to be a lot more aggressive and not to have to worry about running into brick wall in the courts in the first place, in most cases. So for that reason, I think it implies that, it's sort of an obvious thing that enforcement agencies have to be aware that their aggressive positions, at least in today's world, are going to become a different issue when they go into the more than 100 competition law regimes around the world, because they're not operating on the same legal systems that we have here. So maybe the difference between the US and the EU is really a common law versus civil law distinction, because the civil law is sort of takes a more top-down approach and takes its rules from what the government says, develops its rules from what the government says about the law. Maybe that's the core of it. But we have different reasoning processes that are driving the law. And so as a result, I wouldn't be optimistic about some convergence between U.S. monopolization law and European Union monopolization law. There's a real concern there that the European Union will keep going on a much more aggressive track and will not face the strong headwinds that our enforcement agencies run into when they go into court. I'll stop there.
That's great. Thank you, Keith. Thanks for fitting so much into a tight lock. And last up, Doug.
Bill, how much time do I have?
15 minutes. Go ahead and take it all. We'll squeeze. We'll figure it out somehow. I don't want to cut you short, so go ahead.
I just 15 minutes to keep you guys from lunch. Good. Okay. Thanks for the assignment, Phil.
It's one of my three favorite meals, you know.
Okay. Among the many wise things that Brad Smith said is that perspectives really matter, and those of us, people with different perspectives, are going to take away different things from this case and this saga. And regard different things as important. My perspective is that of an antitrust lawyer. I'm not a computer junkie and I'm not an internet junkie. I'm going to look at this as a matter of antitrust law. And if I can do it in 15 minutes, I'm going to touch briefly upon four topics. One, very briefly, I wasn't planning to do, but I'm provoked to do it by what a number of people, including Harry, have said, and that is the issue of remedy. We might get to this in greater detail in the roundtable at the end of the day, but there's been an implicit, I think, premise in a lot of the conversation in the last 24 hours here that what this case is all about or how it should be measured is by the quality or the efficacy of an injunctive remedy intended to restore competition to the market in which there was thought to be a competition problem. And Harry went so far as to suggest that the failure of remedy or flunking remedy 101 might discredit the whole antitrust enterprise. Others have said, certain government officials have said, if you don't have a good remedy in mind, you shouldn't bring the case. And by remedy, I mean I'm talking about injunctive remedies to restore competition. I think this is a very wrong-headed way to think about antitrust. There are a lot of reasons to bring cases other than an injunctive remedy to restore competition. After all, we do not refrain from prosecuting murder cases simply because we cannot resurrect the corpse. And I'll elaborate on that maybe later. Point two, history is written by the winners. And when it's written by the winners, you take what the winners say as if it's true, and I'm going to assume, of course, that the winners here, what they said was true, but you also overlook what you thought or what the world might have thought before the victory, before the winners got to write it. And I think it's important to remember some of the contributions of this case to the way we think about the world, because there are things, I believe, that we take for granted now that were not taken for granted 10 years ago. Network effects is one of them. When this case was filed, network effects were an important part of the government's theory of the case and the application's barrier to entry. And yet, there was a tremendous public debate. I think at least maybe the majority of the commentary at that time said, oh, this is all poppycock. There were articles written saying that the QWERTY story about the typewriter key, which was one of the fables on which the network's effects thing was built, that was all a bunch of nonsense, and that's really not how QWERTY came to be. There were other articles that said if network effect and arguments that were made that if network effects meant anything, they would mean that the incumbent had an impregnable monopoly, and look how, in fact, you know, we went from VisiCalc to series of Schumpeterian changes in these so-called network industries. It's all a bunch of hokum. And today, I think nobody says that. I think we understand network effects is a staple in the way that we view the world. Second, it was thought 10 years ago that tying theory was about leveraging from the tying product market to the tied product market. Now we understand that tying can be looked at more broadly as bundling products for the purpose of, among other things, depending on the circumstances, protecting the market power or excluding rivals from the tying product market. And Dennis Carlton, certainly no leftist, wrote, I think, the first major academic piece sort of formalizing that way of looking at it. Dennis, for those of you who don't know, was a student of Frank Fisher at MIT, and then became the benefactor of the endowed chair that Frank now owns. I think he was able to become a benefactor.
I gave him a good grade, you know.
Well, he always spoke highly of that and said And then Lexicon had its IPO, and he was able to endow it. Okay. So this new way of thinking about tying and bundling, which has spawned to some extent a lot of controversies in bundled pricing as well as tying law, I think was, again, a product of the Microsoft case. Product design innovation, what's the role of antitrust? Coming in the heels of the IBM cases, there was a substantial reason to believe in antitrust, that antitrust doctrine 10 years ago created virtually no room for an antitrust court to second guess a product design. A lot of dicta in cases, no real hard holdings, I suppose. A lot of dicta and almost holdings in cases said, courts, we don't know what to do. We can't second guess. We're not going to be as smart as the engineers at Microsoft. We shouldn't get into this enterprise. The consent decree appeal, Court of Appeals, came very close to saying that. But at the end of the day, the unanimous D.C. Circuit per curiam court and bank Court of Appeals it did second-guess product design at a level that frankly surprised me when they held it was anti-competitive for Microsoft to commingle certain files. And I think that means product design, while I think we all recognize something that the law should approach with considerable caution, is a legitimate subject of antitrust inquiry, and that wasn't something one would have taken for granted 10 years ago. Similarly, 10 years ago, antitrust was a rather formalistic body of law in some ways. There were a lot of categories of analysis, and I think as Steve Holtzman or someone pointed out earlier, maybe it was Phil, one of the reasons the complaint was written the way it was, starting off with exclusive dealing and then tying, was that there was plaintiff-friendly Section 1 doctrine involving those categories. We always knew that this was a case about monopolization. The question was how to present it to a judge in 1998. Back then, you could win a case, or so you thought, if you could show foreclosure of X percent of the market in an exclusive dealing case, or if you could show, or you might lose a case if the exclusive dealing contract was not for a duration of more than a year. And other categories like that, of course, the per se rule in tying. The Court of Appeals opinion, and I think this has had and will have an enduring impact in the way we think about antitrust, has basically said, let's get rid of all these categories. We don't care about 30% thresholds in one year tests. We want to know, on the facts of this case, was the conduct anti-competitive or exclusionary? That, I think, is a major, almost a paradigm shift that we wouldn't have necessarily expected 10 years ago. Monopoly broth, it used to be said, I wrote this in a brief some years ago, 0 + 0 = 0. How can you add up a bunch of conduct that doesn't violate the antitrust laws, accumulate it, and turn it into an antitrust violation? Well, the government argued in the D.C. Circuit implicitly agreed, although it explicitly said it wasn't reaching the issue, implicitly agreed that if you take conduct that is anti-competitive by the appropriate standard, I'll get to that in a second, and it has a tiny impact such that that particular aspect of conduct doesn't have enough of an impact on competition to violate Section 2, but you have a whole mess of that conduct, the cumulative effect of which has a sufficient effect on competition to injure competition, that can violate Section 2, and that's a new way of thinking about antitrust that I think is now conventional. So I think we should not forget the many things that antitrust now takes for granted that were either surprising or at least hotly contested 10 years ago. Okay, third topic. The case didn't resolve everything, obviously, in terms of antitrust doctrine. One of the most interesting and important things where it really kind of, it maybe stirred up a hornet's nest, was the antitrust intellectual property interface. Microsoft argued a constellation of arguments about innovation, high technology industries, high fixed costs, low variable cost industries, and intellectual property, and said this is not something that antitrust tools, antitrust doctrine is well equipped to grapple with, and they did raise obviously some difficult questions. Court of Appeals unanimously said poppycock, in fact, characterized Microsoft's most sweeping argument of a kind of intellectual property immunity as bordering on the frivolous, gave sort of short shrift to its arguments that because we're talking about the aspects of its copyrighted software, it was in a safe harbor. Now, that was just the tip of the iceberg. Now we have, of course, a robust industry, which I'm having a lot of fun with, in the intersection of antitrust and intellectual property. in all sorts of areas involving patent pool, standard setting, and who knows what else. So this case didn't, Microsoft didn't resolve it, but it certainly put it on the table for antitrust, the grist for the antitrust mill. And then finally, and somewhat disappointingly from my perspective, the case did not resolve the question of what do we mean by anti-competitive conduct for Section 2 of the Sherman Act. The government had argued essentially for what has now come to be known as the no economic sense test. That is to say, would this conduct have made economic sense for the defendant if it had not excluded rivals and enabled the defendant to maintain or preserve market power it otherwise wouldn't have had? That's not, I think, contrary to what Professor Hilton said, I don't think that test is inconsistent at all with a dynamic innovation sensitive analysis, because all you have to do in that analysis, and what the government argued in this case, is you ask yourself, would the legitimate payoffs of an investment in innovation have justified this conduct, even if it had not raised rivals' costs in ways that that created additional market power? That's a fairly conservative test. The D.C. Circuit appeared to go beyond that to the left by saying, no, we're not just going to look at that question. We're going to balance in cases where there's both benefit and harm. We're going to balance the two. But in its application, I'm not sure the D.C. Circuit actually meant that. I'm not sure any court has actually ever balanced. What the D.C. Circuit seemed to do is to say, if there is an efficiency that is proven for the conduct, even if that efficiency wouldn't have justified the defendant's investment, that is to say, wouldn't have been enough to make the conduct profitable for the defendant, if there is an efficiency, defendant's going to win. If there's no efficiency and there's harm to competition, only then does the plaintiff win. But that issue's not been resolved because it's not clear what the D.C. Circuit meant, and there's the DOJ Section 2 report and the FTC assault on it clearly indicate that widespread disagreement about that critical question of what is anti-competitive conduct for Section 2. Fourth and final point I want to make, and this is something I think is lost sight of, although I have a hunch that our friends from Microsoft haven't lost sight of it. The Microsoft case, US v. Microsoft, was doctrinally, to my lights, a very conservative case. Not, completely hard right, but a very conservative case. The conduct standard was this no economic sense standard, which is way to the right of a ad hoc balancing test, way to the right of where the EC is, even to the right in this respect of the DOJ's recently released report, which explicitly said we don't like the no economic sense test because it would permit a defendant to prevail with a modest efficiency contribution to society, even if there's a substantial long-run impact on rivals and on competition. Measured, I guess, by where antitrust doctrine is today, the case, I think, was quite modest, and if it was not a conservative case in its contribution, it may be mostly because it stirred the pot and perhaps contributed to where the EC is today and to where the FTC wants to be today.
Wonderful, thank you. That's a huge tour of topics in a very short time. I appreciate this.